You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hi, welcome back to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security. We just want to remind you, it's just six more months before 702 of the FISA statute is set to expire again. This is one of the most important intelligence tools we have, and 702 refers to collection of non-U.S. persons overseas, not in the United States. And yet we continue to have these conversations about allowing this to sunset. So we thought it might be important for you to hear two people who know a lot about 702, what gave rise to any questions about it, and why it merits reauthorization. So Josh Geltzer and Glenn Gerstel, the former general counsel of NSA. My guest today is the Deputy Assistant to the President of the United States and the Deputy Homeland Security Advisor to President Biden, Josh Geltzer. Josh, good to see you.
Good to see you as well. Thanks so much for the invitation.
My pleasure. So, you know, not everybody listening to this podcast is going to know the greater refinements of 702. And I think in fairness to intelligent listeners everywhere, it might be helpful for you to start with what 702 is and what it is not.
Absolutely. In a nutshell, Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, allows the executive branch in a court-supervised way to obtain communications targeting only non-U.S. persons located abroad, enlisting the assistance of U.S. communications service providers. Now, let me just unpack that as well. There are non-U.S. persons located abroad who use U.S. technologies for the same reasons we all use them, because they are reliable, because they are cheap, because they are effective and fun to use. And those who would do harm using our own technologies against us can be important targets for intelligence collection. And I'm sure we'll talk about some of the types of intelligence that can be obtained through their communications. But what 702 allows is for the executive branch, under the supervision of the FISA court, to go to these companies to get those non-U.S. persons located abroad's communications in order to protect national security and advance foreign policy.
Okay, seems pretty basic. Doesn't seem to have too much to do with people in the United States. Frankly, has nothing to do. But let's talk for a minute about why 702 is important. When we already have an executive order, 12333, that authorizes collection of foreign intelligence information, what does 702 bring to the table that's not already there?
It's such an important question. So just as you say, you might think about executive order 12333 as one side of a spectrum. It's non-U.S. persons located abroad whose intelligence, whose communications are of intelligence value to us. And then think of the other side of the spectrum. So this is what's covered by what's called traditional FISA, Title I of FISA, which tends to be people on U.S. soil whose communications are of intelligence value. Now, 702 is a bit in the middle of those, though much closer to 12333. It is non-U.S. persons, and they are located abroad. That makes it just like the targets of 12333 collection. But there's one quirk. The quirk is that they are using U.S. communications technologies in order to communicate. Now, in a sense, this is giving them a bit of extra protection in our system. They don't have any Fourth Amendment rights. That's the clear case law regarding non-U.S. persons located abroad. But they are touching the wires that are U.S. in a sense. They are using U.S. companies in order to communicate. And so Congress, to keep up with the technological evolution that led to this, essentially crafted a compromise. Instead of 12333, where there's no statutory framework for it, but also instead of traditional FISA Title I, where the executive branch goes to the FISA court for every particular target of collection, because they're on U.S. soil, under 702, the executive branch goes once a year to the FISA court. It tells the court what topics it would like to collect on. The court approves those, and then the executive branch is able to work with tech companies in figuring out the appropriate particular targets of collection within those topics.
Okay, so there's no risk that somebody, say, in Michigan is going to be targeted, because it has to be two things, correct? It has to be A person who's located overseas who is not a U.S. person.
That's exactly right. And indeed, the statute, 702 itself, includes an explicit prohibition on so-called reverse targeting, where you target someone abroad with the real intent of collecting on a U.S. person or someone in the U.S. Now, at the same time, I should say, just like was anticipated when this statute was created, some of the targets of collection do turn out to be talking to U.S. persons. Again, this was expected. Indeed, this was some of the most concerning type of communication that 702 was designed to enable collection of. Think about it. It was originally a predominantly counterterrorism tool. And when it was passed post 9/11, there was particular concern about those non-U.S. persons located abroad who might be trying to recruit, radicalize, help plot terrorist attacks in the United States. And so it is true that collecting on non-U.S. persons located abroad can sometimes reveal some very important communications between them and U.S. persons, not only of the counterterrorism variety, but recruiting spies, attempting hacks. All of this can be revealed through 702 collection.
Right. And in reality, we live in a global economy. I mean, there is a lot of international travel. There is a lot of trade that takes place over internets and networks. And we also live in a time of war and climate change where immigration flows seem to be faster than at almost any other time in history. So, yes, I mean, if a U.S. person is talking to a target of foreign intelligence, in other words, a foreigner located somewhere else, how do we prevent or limit that from happening? In other words, what are the mitigation tools that we can use to avoid all of this? And should we prevent that if these U.S. persons communicating may be involved in plotting against the United States? And I'm not just talking about terrorism here, but, you know, to steal trade secrets, you know, which could torpedo an entire company somewhere. Shouldn't it be okay to do this, Josh?
I think this is critical to the ongoing conversation about 702's reauthorization. And so I'm glad we're spending time on it. It is our view from experience that being able to sort and sift information lawfully obtained under 702 around U.S. persons where that's reasonably likely to return foreign intelligence value is among the most important aspects of 702 collection. Again, let me give you an example. Imagine if we have in other intelligence indications that there's been, let's say, a hack of a major company, but we want to try to figure out, and quickly, who's been hacked. We might be able to use 702 collection to indicate that the hack has been of a German company, a Dutch company, or a U.S. company, so that we could alert that company, help them mitigate, help trace who the hacker was. It would seem a very bizarre state of affairs if we could sort and sift lawfully collected 702 information around identifying if it was a German victim company or a Dutch victim company, but not a U.S. victim company, which is, after all, what the U.S. taxpayer pays the intelligence community to do, protect ultimately U.S. persons, U.S. national security interests. So it is both critical that there be an ability to sort and sift lawfully collected information in this way, and critical that there be guardrails. And those exist, and indeed, we have worked very hard to strengthen those over the past few years. That has included some sensitive U.S. person queries conducted by the FBI being approved at higher levels, some even at the deputy director level. And it has involved creating an opt-in requirement so that if 702 collected information is to be searched by an FBI agent or analyst using U.S. person information, that they need to explain why that meets the relevant standards and deliberately choose to do so.
Okay. And you said something important. You know, when you think of the IC or the intelligence community, I mean, we're talking about this sort of behemoth, probably, you know, the best in the world. But among the agencies that are in the IC or the NSA, the CIA, obviously the National Counterterrorism Center and the FBI, are all of those agencies places where people can query this database if they had a question about a U.S. person who is, by U.S. person, we would include corporations, but who may have been somehow hacked or communicated with by a foreign entity who is otherwise a legitimate and important target of 702. Can all of these people working there sort of have at this database, or are there some guardrails?
There are a lot of guardrails. It's a critical question. So as your question rightly indicates, there are four parts of our government that have access to so-called raw 702 information, the actual take. And those are the National Security Agency, the Central Intelligence Agency, the National Counterterrorism Center, and the FBI. Now, even what they have access to within 702 collection is limited. For example, the FBI only gets less than 4% of the information collected under 702, only information associated with a predicated investigation. The theory is that the FBI really needs information where it relates to their investigations to fulfill its essential mission of protecting the homeland, but it doesn't need access to things that are just general foreign intelligence insights and information, where instead it's more appropriate for NSA or CIA to have it and be able to incorporate it into analysis. Now, I should emphasize, beyond those four agencies, a number of us benefit from 702 in the form of finished intelligence, but those are the four parts of our government that have access to the raw 702 tape. As I say, even that is further limited. And for example, at FBI, where U.S. person queries have become a central part of the discussion about reauthorization, there is now a training regimen in place that those who can engage in access to 702 information need to have proper training, recertified training, and if they make certain errors, they will lose the ability to continue to have access to that information.
Okay, and you said something that's kind of a buzzword, and I want to key in on that because I think not every listener is going to understand. When you use a phrase like a predicated investigation, I mean, we should probably talk about that for 1 second, which is, just to be clear, under the Privacy Act and the DIOG, which is the, what is it, Director's Investigative and Operations Guidance, you can't have a predicated investigation based solely on First Amendment protected activity. So we're not talking about somebody expressing opinions. A predicated investigation has to be something that involves serious criminal conduct or suspicion of serious criminal conduct. Is that right?
You are right that the FBI is not allowed to predicate to open investigation based purely on First Amendment protected activities. And there are other constraints set out in the DIOG and elsewhere. When the FBI is receiving 702 information related to predicated investigations, all those thresholds need to be met for those investigations to be, again, predicated or opened in the first place. And then the idea is they should have access to lawfully obtained information that can help illuminate and expand on their body of knowledge related to those investigations. And it's just worth emphasizing that that lesson, that takeaway, was a central one, perhaps even the central one, from the 9/11 Commission report, from the Webster Commission report that came out of Fort Hood. The critical takeaway from those studies in the wake of two tragedies was that we can't, as a government, afford to blind ourselves, to erect walls to separate already lawfully obtained, lawfully collected information. In fact, those two commissions said the opposite. Tear down walls and find ways to ensure that you are putting together the pieces that allow terrorist attacks to be stopped and spies not to be recruited in the homeland and critical infrastructure not to be penetrated by hostile foreign actors. As we, as an executive branch right now, resist strongly the suggestions some have made that we should, for example, have to go to the FISA court every time we want to search or sift within lawfully collected 702 information using an identifier associated with a U.S. person, we think it's our responsibility to do the opposite and indeed to utilize that information swiftly and capably and nimbly for the purpose it was collected, which is to protect national security.
You also just talked about the fact that you said earlier, there's specialized training. There's obviously an audit trail of any query, correct?
That's right.
And we're talking about information related only to predicated investigations. And all of these things are reviewed, I think, almost every, 90 days or whatever within the FBI to make sure that there's still predication, that it's still meritorious to keep open. But we're not talking about a situation where anyone could just query because they're having a bad day, or they don't like the person's name or something like that. It sounds like there really is a lot to prevent sort of any abuse of this. But let's turn for just a second, because recently President Biden assembled an advisory board to examine 702 authorities. And that advisory board put together a substantive report, which we will hyperlink in the notes to this podcast for people who want a deeper dive. But why don't you talk about, for just a moment, what the board concluded through its examination of this authority?
It's a really important report, and I would commend it to your listeners. And the PIAB, the President's Intelligence Advisory Board, which has existed since the Eisenhower administration to provide nonpartisan advice to the president on intelligence matters, and which currently has a former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs on it, a former Secretary of Homeland Security, former Chief of Staff to the CIA director. The PIAB came back with an extensive report on 702 that had, I would say, three central conclusions. One, that were Congress to allow this authority to sunset, to lapse at the end of this year, it would be likely the greatest intelligence failure of a generation, and it would be self-inflicted. The second conclusion was that being able to conduct these queries that we've been talking about, those whose identifiers are associated with U.S. persons, is absolutely essential to the vision for this authority in the first place, in which we're able to understand when non-U.S. persons located abroad are presenting threats to the homeland, including by trying to interact with those in the homeland whom they wish to see become terrorist actors or spies or infiltrators of critical infrastructure. And the third point that the board made, which I think is an important one, is that we have worked hard to improve compliance, and we need to continue to do so. And I mentioned before some of the updates that we've made over the past few years and how FBI in particular conducts these U.S. person queries that have become a focal point for debate. And those reforms of 2021, there have been more since, led to a drop by 93% of the number of U.S. person queries conducted by the FBI, and an increase in the compliance rate of the queries that are conducted. All of this, to my mind, shows that this reauthorization cycle presents an opportunity to keep in place a statutory authority that is absolutely essential to understanding Chinese origins of fentanyl, of Russian atrocities in Ukraine, of weapons of mass destruction components before they reach foreign actors, and to entrench in statute some of the progress we've already made as a matter of policy in expanding and improving the guardrails and compliance within that. But the alternative, and the board is very clear about this, is that for this reauthorization cycle to lead to a lapse or a sunset of this law is really to go blind at a moment when our country cannot afford to do so.
It's interesting we're having this conversation when it was less than 6 years ago that the Hill was asking questions and expressing concern about the concept of going dark. And yet we find ourselves at this point. Do you think, though, that this sort of simple and clear message about the importance of 702 intelligence collection has really made its way into the minds of the American public? Do you think that they understand this to be a clear sort of nonpartisan concern, or is there still work to be done in that sort of messaging space?
I think it is incumbent on us to keep doing what we've been trying to do for months, but know that we need to continue to do it, which is making this case, explaining why this authority is of such extraordinary value, especially at this time. And part of that has been working with the intelligence community to declassify very concrete examples that illustrate the value of this authority. So we've been able to say publicly that Section 702 has identified threats to U.S. troops. We've declassified that 702 has disrupted planned terrorist attacks at home and abroad and has contributed to the successful operation that took Ayman al-Zawahiri, the global head of al-Qaeda, off the battlefield last summer. We have declassified that 702 has resulted in the disruption of hostile foreign actors' attempts to recruit spies in the United States and to send their operatives into the United States. We've declassified that 702 has identified key economic security risks, including strategic malign investment by foreign actors. I could go on, but I think what this speaks to is our very conscious effort to make this case to the U.S. Congress and to the public in a way that helps them understand the work of the intelligence community, the responsible ways in which the community utilizes its authority, but also how devastating it would be with all the challenges the United States faces in the world at the current time to somehow lose this authority wholesale, or to see it reauthorized in a form where it's so diminished that we, in effect, lose these types of insights.
Part and parcel of any discussion of intelligence collection, though, is the fact that the general power and scope of the IC, it has not always functioned with the Constitution forefront. And we've learned this in a couple of instances, right? You might remember there were the Pike and the Church commissions of the late 1970s that resulted in things like the FISA statute and the Classified Information Procedures Act and the discussion of the gray mailing that was preventing so many cases from being brought at that time. When people look at the sort of size, the power, and frankly, the efficacy of the U.S. intelligence community, and they feel a little nervous about any authority that is expansive, what in terms of messaging and sort of facts can be done to address these sort of broader concerns about the scope of government and authority in general, as embodied as they may imagine it in something like 702?
It's a terrific question and an important issue to all of us who work in this area, who see people working hard to administer these sorts of complex programs and who want the public to be reassured in the way that they're handled. And I'll go right to the fact that there have been compliance errors associated with 702 in the past. It's a complex system, but that's no excuse. Compliance errors are unacceptable, and we say that explicitly and publicly, and we should. Now, the second thing to say is we've worked hard to figure out better ways to administer this program. And again, I've sat in the Hoover Building where FBI is based, and I've seen the overhaul to their systems that they have put in place in the past 2 years that prevents the sort of inadvertent searches of 702 collected information that were a large, large part of compliance errors of the past by now requiring opt-in and indeed opt-in with explanation, whereas in the past there was an opt-out requirement. That's why this reauthorization cycle strikes me as such an important opportunity. It is not just a chance to ensure continuity and collection on the most important global issues of the day, issues that should matter to all Americans, whether that's Russian atrocities in Ukraine or how the supply chain of fentanyl works before ultimately leading to this deadly drug being in American communities. It is that, but it is also a chance to entrench in law so that it's far, far harder to roll back some of the guardrails and improvements we have already instituted as a matter of policy to prevent the sort of compliance errors that have cropped up in the past. Whatever angle you come at these issues from, whether focused on the security benefits of 702 collection or whether focused on some of that skepticism and a desire to see guardrails and constraints, I think both sides can win this reauthorization cycle.
Let's look back. I have read, and I read almost every 2 or 3 years, I reread Sun Tzu's Art of War. I try to look back at some of the wisdom of the Stoics, but I want to take sort of a broad historical look. Where all empires fall at some point, but in all of history, can you think of any time when a country facing the magnitude of external threats that we face today voluntarily gave up a source of important intelligence that was used to protect its citizens and its national security?
I can't say I could point to an example, and it really leads to that very, very striking line from the board we mentioned before, the President's Intelligence Advisory Board, which points out that there can be intelligence failures over time, but for this authority to expire and expire right now would be the self-inflicted variety, the type that we really can't afford to have in a moment when the world is I think, hungry for U.S. leadership, and in which this authority allows us insights into the sort of things where we're rallying the world, to the defense of Ukraine, its sovereignty, by allowing us insight into the atrocities that Russia is inflicting there. And, you know, I'll give you one statistic that I think speaks to the breadth of 702 collection, which is the fact that 59% of articles in the president's daily brief, the PDB, in calendar year 2022, contained Section 702 information reported by the National Security Agency. 59%. So if you imagine what the president is reading every day as he tries to grapple with these hard decisions on behalf of the American people, and then from about two-thirds of those, eliminating some piece of the information sustaining and forming that analysis, that feels like the exact opposite direction we want to go in as we grapple with complex and important choices facing the president, facing senior policymakers, and facing the American people, ultimately.
Okay, well, I'm sure there's some lesson to be gleaned from the fall of Rome. So I'm going to go research that, and I'll come back to you. But let me ask you this. I know we're on track right now. It's up for reauthorization. What is the status of the reauthorization on the Hill? And what source would you recommend listeners use to track the progress of 702 renewal?
So we have been extensively engaged with members and their staff on the Hill for many months now, as we have done what we think is our responsibility, which is help educate and inform about both what this program is and isn't, and what value it yields. And it's worth pointing out that as we approach the looming sunset of this in December, 60% of the U.S. House of Representatives has never before voted on 702, and a quarter of the Senate has never before voted on it. That's just the extent of turnover in both parts of the U.S. Congress over the past 5 years. And that, to our minds, has only raised the importance of us doing what we've worked very hard to do, which is educate and inform in whatever setting members and staff wanted about this critical authority and how it's administered. We have been very gratified at the level of engagement we've received from members, from their staffs. We have, of course, spent a lot of time in direct conversation with them about different changes that could or could not be made to the authority, and providing our candid feedback on those that we think would be doable, those that we think would be beneficial, and those that we think would be quite detrimental. And we look forward to ramping up that engagement in the months to come. I think for listeners who want to follow this, it's worth looking at a page that the Office of the Director of National Intelligence has created, where we have worked hard as an executive branch to provide, at least in unclassified form, some of the very same resources we are providing to members of Congress on the Hill. There's a two-page fact sheet there that summarizes in very pithy form key vignettes we've declassified showing the utility of this authority. There's also a much longer document there that talks about the civil rights and civil liberties protections built into 702, the way it functions, and that provides at greater length some illustrations of the value of this authority. And I'm sure following those sorts of resources will help provide insight into what we anticipate being a very lively continued conversation with the Hill in the months to come.
In addition, I would say, if you're not familiar with any of the ways to track these things in Congress, there are occasional summaries on GovTrack, which is one source. And then, of course, you can always use Congress, congress.gov, I think it is. And they have an app. If you have to have an app for everything, they've got that. This has been a very good conversation, and I really appreciate sort of hearing all the refinements on sort of the mitigation of any problems with 702. And I am going to come back to you at some point, Josh, because I do want to know if you can identify any moment in history when a great power gave up an intelligence collection tool, because I couldn't find one.
If I discover it, you're going to be the first to know. I promise you that.
All right. Well, that's good, because I think when we talk about critical infrastructure being threatened from cyber threats and the value of 702, I'm not sure the average person knows what we mean by critical infrastructure, but it means things like the banking system, our utility systems, the grid, things that we need for our very survival. So obviously, this is an important authority. Would you like to say anything else to our listeners before we let you go tonight?
I am very grateful for the chance to talk with you, Elisa, about this critical authority, and really urge those who care about foreign policy and national security issues across the spectrum, whether it's China, whether it's Russia, whether it's cyber, whether it's critical infrastructure, whether it's terrorism, whether it's strategic malign investment, to look at some of the resources we've made available that illustrate just how important 702 collection is to protecting American national security, and just how devastating it would be for the authority to sunset at the end of the year.
Glenn Gerstle is the former general counsel of the National Security Agency, or the NSA. Thanks so much for coming in. I'm glad that you did.
Same for me. Delighted to be back.
Glenn, you were heavily involved in the last congressional reauthorization debate in 2017 and 2018, feels like yesterday, and that was while you were at the NSA. Can you briefly set the stage for our listeners? What does 702 cover, and why has reauthorization been so contentious?
So to set the stage for 702, we sort of have to go back a little bit to the origins of FISA. It's a 45-year-old statute that was put in place following abuses that were uncovered in the intelligence and law enforcement area by the so-called Church-Pike hearings. And Congress set up a rather detailed scheme for undertaking foreign intelligence surveillance within the bounds of the Fourth Amendment And that was a carefully crafted series of compromises and technical statutes that were set up under FISA in 1978. Not surprisingly, technology evolved to the point where after 9/11, we were focusing on different targets who were using different means of communication than had been originally the case when FISA was first adopted, because at the time, most international phone calls were carried by satellite. But of course, by the 2000s, that had turned around and foreign phone calls were being conducted by subsea and terrestrial cables. And a massive amount of communication was, of course, handled by the internet, with email not even existing at the time of FISA. So the law was changed in 2008 to adopt Section 702. At the time, it was a little bit contentious, to be sure. I mean, every time it's been renewed, again in 2012 and again in 2018 and 17, as you described, there's always been some controversy over it. We'll talk about why that's the case. But what 702 does is pretty simple. It's a foreign intelligence surveillance program that is aimed at foreigners located overseas for the purpose of collecting foreign intelligence information. And the reason it works is in some ways a testament to American technology, which is to say that the world communicates through American platforms, internet platforms, and telephone platforms. And the result is that the American intelligence community is able to go to these providers of internet services and telecommunication services, and under the compelled orders issued by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which was the court that was set up under the FISA statute originally, require those providers to hand over information, emails, telephone calls, other communications from the targets, from the foreign targets. And that's, as I said, it's a function of the fact that both the good guys and the bad guys communicate using American platform. The reason this is all controversial, going back to the original adoption of FISA, is that inevitably, when foreigners are talking to each other, they might also either be mentioning an American or they might be talking to an American. So inevitably, although it's not intended and not the goal of 702, inevitably it's the case that some Americans' communications are picked up when the intelligence community is focused on foreigners. And that's the cause of the concern.
This begs the question, of course, of what's left if 702 is not available. What is the alternative, if any, authority that the intelligence community can rely upon if for some reason the statutory authority under 702 lapses in a dysfunctional Congress?
Well, as I said, one of the reasons 702 works is because it reflects the fact that the world communicates via American communications platforms. So that means that if the intelligence community needs to access that information in a compelled way, in a manner consistent with the Fourth Amendment, from an American communications platform, a internet provider or a telephone company, it needs a court order. And if it doesn't, and the way it gets that court order is pursuant to the authorities contained in Section 702. There's no substitute for it. The only other way to obtain that kind of information is through the law enforcement process of a criminal warrant, but that's not relevant here. We're talking about obtaining information for foreign intelligence purposes, and FISA is the exclusive means for doing that. So if we don't have Section 702, it is not possible for the government to have other legal basis in the United States for doing the same thing. Overseas, we could probably get similar information, but not completely, just pursuant to the general authorities of the commander-in-chief, as enunciated in something called Executive Order 12333, which governs sort of overseas activities that aren't covered by the Fourth Amendment. But that's not going to fully answer this because, as I said, the fact of the matter is that communications via American platforms are so relevant. ISIS terrorists use American platforms. They use WhatsApp, Google, YouTube, whatever. So do Russian agents. So do Chinese spies. So do fentanyl traffickers. And that's the issue that we need to be concerned about.
Let's move forward here. There are two bills right now, or two, like maybe four versions of bills in Congress. What is the current state of play on the Hill? And what are the major contentions and contenders at this point? Can you bring us up to date on the pending legislation? And if you have any predictions, prognostications, we always welcome those as well.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to say right now that I'm not going to engage in any predictions because that would be a fool's errand. It's hard enough as it is to figure out what the situation is at the moment, let alone to make predictions about it. But let's try to figure out where we are at the moment. Interestingly enough, there are bipartisan agreements in both the House and Senate on different approaches. So this is not a pure Republican versus Democratic issue. More specifically, in the Senate, Senator Wyden and a number of other co-sponsors have introduced some legislation following on a little bit from an earlier bill, the Fourth Amendment is Not for Sale Act. The Wyden bill is a privacy-oriented bill that would eliminate the ability to undertake these United States person queries that we've been talking about, unless certain exceptions were available, such as there was already a criminal warrant or the person consented, et cetera. So there's a lot of tightening up there. There are tightening up provisions of making sure that the queries are done for the sole purpose of finding foreign intelligence. There's limits on getting warrants to determine geolocation and web browsing history. There's also an expanded section on in Senator Wyden's bill that would prohibit law enforcement from buying certain kinds of personal data from data brokers, something that's been the subject of proposed privacy legislation for a long time. There's also a provision in there that bars the or limits the use of stingrays, so-called cell site simulators in the United States, provisions dealing with collecting information from vehicles, even some provisions addressing queries undertaken under Executive Order 12333 regarding foreign intelligence collection. So it's a very broad bill that I would say meets almost all the suggestions of the privacy advocates. And there are both Republican and Democratic sponsors on it. Also in the Senate, Senators Warner and Rubio from the Select Committee on Intelligence have their bill, which would reauthorize FISA with some but not all of these privacy provisions, most notably eliminating the requirement for a warrant in order to do queries, but also containing very strong provisions that would further impose restrictions on the FBI and improve transparency of the FISA court and take some other steps. That's mirrored in the House. In the Senate, I think the odds are, if you ask me to make some predictions, I think there's a little bit more support for Senators Warner and Rubio's bill. That's not the case in the House, where there's a mirror images. There's a bill from the Chairman Jordan's Judiciary Committee, which is very close to the Wyden bill that I just described, with significant privacy protections and in some ways goes even further. And there's also a bill from the Intelligence Committee on the House that is very similar to the bill on the Senate side. And again, both of those have bipartisan supporters. It's unclear right now, perhaps by the time this podcast comes out, we'll have a little better sense of what exactly is happening procedurally. But all of this is going to need to get resolved between the two houses in the form of a conference.
I do wonder, listening to you, Glenn, that some of this effort to sort of reach into authorities under 12333 doesn't walk into separation of powers issues between Article 1 and Article 2. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. But let's take a moment to go deeper in the so-called warrant requirement, since that appears to be the main distinction between some of these approaches. Is a warrant actually constitutionally required, as some people have claimed or perhaps would like to believe?
A warrant for undertaking queries. I think the answer to that is that there is, and I think that's a pretty clear answer, which is there is no constitutional requirement to get a warrant. We do not, in other areas of federal government, we do not generally have a requirement that in order for the government to go look at information it's already lawfully collected, it needs a warrant. So just think, for example, when you show up at the airport and hand your passport or driver's license to the TSA agent, who then plugs your name in a computer of lawfully acquired information, no warrant is needed to do that kind of search. The courts that have looked at this, and admittedly there haven't been very many, have said that the Constitution does not require a warrant to undertake the query. The courts that are most concerned about this, that have the most expertise and have the deepest appreciation of the circumstances in which these queries would be undertaken, are, of course, the judges in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. On at least three occasions, perhaps four, in 2015, 2018, again in 2023, after asking amicus to be appointed to specifically brief this issue, they have reached the conclusion that there is no constitutional requirement for a warrant in the context of doing these queries. That is completely constitutional. The few district courts that have looked at this, most notably the district court in Portland in the Muhammad case, that was the Christmas tree bomb plot, you may recall, specifically looked at that and said no warrant is a requirement. The only thing on the other side of the ledger, and it's important, I'll be fair about that, is a Second Circuit opinion It is a court of appeals opinion, which, not in a direct holding, said it may well be a separate event that we need to look at for constitutional purposes. And maybe, I underscore, maybe there's a requirement for a warrant, but it didn't say there was. And there's even some language in the opinion that suggests that when the FBI is doing a query, maybe there is no such requirement. But it referred the matter back to the district court, so there's no definitive holding on it. And about the most you could say is that there have been a handful of courts that have addressed the issue. None have found there's a constitutional requirement. And admittedly, the Supreme Court has not definitively addressed this, and it may never have occasion to.
Based on your sort of collective years of inhabiting the national security ecosystem and understanding all of these threats, I'd like to get your thoughts a little bit more granularly about what these guardrails should look like. What are your thoughts about what would work here?
I think the President's Intelligence Advisory Board came up with a series of very thoughtful recommendations. They had 13 odd recommendations as to ways to improve transparency in the program, to increase privacy, while at the same time maintaining the operational effectiveness. I think it does make sense to eliminate the ability to do queries for domestic crimes only. That had been a big point of contention for many years with privacy advocates. The FBI instituted new rules that would greatly limit the circumstances under which they could query the database, not for foreign intelligence information, but just for criminal, domestic criminal purposes. And it's a tiny, tiny fraction of what they need to do. And getting rid of it, I think, would go a long way to increasing confidence that the FBI is focusing on this in the right way for foreign intelligence purposes. Other provisions that are talked about in these various bills do things like limit the number of people at the FBI who can undertake these kinds of queries. Seems to make sense to me. I do like the idea of a two-person check, which had been suggested in the PIAB report. They suggested the FBI emulate the NSA in that regard before undertaking some of these queries. Additional penalties and accountability for wrongful or even careless acts seems to make sense to me. I think people should be, you know, on their toes when they're doing this kind of very sensitive work. So there's a wide range of provisions that I think there's some common ground between the judiciary bill and the HPSI bill, which they are the first to admit that they're similar provisions that overlap, not totally, of course, but the provisions that overlap between the two of them, I think, make a lot of sense. And I think we'll probably see Congress adopt some version of those additional protections.
Our guest tonight has been Glenn Gerstle, the former general counsel of NSA. Thank you for listening to NSLT. Remember to share this episode with a friend. Of course, if you know anybody on HPSI, SISI, share with them. Go ahead. Or you can share it with a colleague, but discuss the issues that we've presented thoughtfully with one another. Understanding the issues well and relying on hard information facts. If you had feedback for us, please reach out to us via social media like Facebook, Threads, and Twitter. Yes, we're still calling it Twitter while it lasts. Our handle is always at ABANATSEC. Or if you're feeling very old-fashioned, email us like you did in the olden days. You can reach us at nationalsecurity@americanbar.org. Our editor and producer is Francis Burkham. Our program manager is Rebecca Salido, and my co-producer is Holly McMahon. Producer and writer of this podcast is me, Elisa Poteet, always here in my individual capacity. And help is always coming from the incredible members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.